Montana's U.S. House race is getting more crowded. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck, and Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Gun advocates want the U.S. Supreme Court to rule on a Montana gun law. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with security expert David Hammond about the threat posed by cyber attacks. The already crowded field of candidates vying for Montana's U.S. House seat continues to grow. Current Republican Representative Steve Daines announced earlier this month he will be running for the Senate seat being vacated by Democratic Senator Max Baucus in 2014. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us all this comes still more than a month before candidates can officially file for office.
Helena real estate investor Drew Turiano says he's running for the House seat as a Republican. It's his second time running for office in Montana. He came in last in a four-way Republican primary for Secretary of State in 2012. He hopes that loss has helped with name recognition for this race.
What I offer Montana is conservatism. That's why I'm running.
He describes himself as a Christian Tea Party conservative Republican. Turiano says he's completely against abortion and takes a hardline stance against illegal immigration. He says he's a strong believer in the concept of nullification,
where states can reject unconstitutional judicial mandates or unconstitutional federal laws like Obamacare, for instance, like Roe v. Wade, for instance.
The theory of nullification has been repeatedly rejected by the courts. But Turiano is not swayed in his conservative stances, even if they lead to criticism from Democrats or even Republicans.
I don't mind if they call me names. Some candidates, unfortunately, do mind being called names, and they don't take a hard position on some of these issues, which a lot of conservatives in Montana really want them to take a hard position.
Turiano joins three other candidates who say they will be running on the Republican side. Former Republican legislators Corey Stapleton and Ryan Zinke say they will run, as well as current Glendive Republican Senator Matt Rosendale. Former Secretary of State Brand Johnson also says he is planning to run, but Johnson says he's waiting to make his formal announcement until after the first of the year.
Folks have a lot of other things to focus on, family and friends and quality time over the holidays, and we just didn't want to get in the middle of all that.
Plus, he says his announcement may get more undivided attention if he makes it separate from the rest of the pack. As of now, the Democratic side of the House race has two candidates, former Max Baucus State Director John Lewis and Missoula writer Melinda Gopher. The race also now has its first independent candidate. Helena resident Sean White Wolf works for the Montana United Indian Association, which helps Native Americans pursue education and find jobs. White Wolf says he has run twice unsuccessfully for the state legislature before, once as a Republican and another time as a Democrat. He says it's taken him a while to find where he stands on issues. Now, he says he's fiscally conservative but socially liberal. Running as an independent allows him to avoid being put in a political box. He says he wants to direct his focus to finding jobs for poor people.
People who are working, you know, two or three jobs and still live under the poverty rate, they need help. You know, they need help with their health care, and they need help with food and things like that.
As for social issues, he says he'll let other candidates campaign on those.
They can scream about it all they want.
White Wolf says his first priority is to gather almost 13,000 signatures. He needs that to run for office because independents are not part of what are called qualified parties in Montana. Those parties are the Republican, Democratic, and Libertarian parties. They qualify by having a certain number of candidates on ballots over a certain amount of time. Candidates in these parties don't have to gather signatures. However, none of the candidates of any party who have announced their intentions can actually file yet. Here's Secretary of State Linda McCullough.
No, they can't file with our office until January 9th.
The last day to file for office in 2014 is March 10th. However, McCullough says a candidate does have to file with the Commissioner of Political Practices if they have already started raising money. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
And in other news from around the state, gun advocates are asking the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn a lower court's ruling against the state laws designed to buck federal gun rules. Earlier this year, the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals upheld a district judge's decision against the 2009 Montana Firearms Freedom Act. The measure has since been passed in other pro-gun states. The law's attempt to declare the federal firearm regulations don't apply to guns kept in the state where they were manufactured. The Justice Department has successfully argued that the courts have already decided Congress can use its power to regulate interstate commerce. Gun advocates asked the Supreme Court today to limit the reach of Congress to regulate guns. The Supreme Court is expected to decide next year whether to accept the request.
Officials in Cascade County have released the name of a 24-year-old Missoula man who died in a weekend rollover crash south of Great Falls. The coroner's office tells the Great Falls Tribune that Cody John Juhas died in the crash Saturday night. The Montana Highway Patrol says Juhas was eastbound on Wilson Butte Road at 7:45 p.m. Saturday night when he failed to negotiate a downhill turn and went off the road. His car rolled several times and came to rest on the road. Juhas was ejected from the vehicle.
A man who tried to rob a Helena casino ended up in the hospital instead after an employee struck him numerous times with an aluminum baseball bat. Officers responded to the Copper Club Casino in the western part of Helena yesterday to find an employee holding a suspect down in the parking lot. This is according to an email sent by Police Chief Troy McGee to the Independent Record. The employee told police that two men with bandanas over their faces entered the casino, demanded money, and began assaulting the employee after he told them to leave. The man said he triggered the robbery alarm, grabbed an aluminum baseball bat, and hit one of the suspects, who eventually fled. The other man ran into the parking lot, but the employee followed, hitting him several times with the bat.
A Bozeman man faces a negligent endangerment charge after apparently firing a shot through the ceiling of his apartment, injuring his upstairs neighbor. Benjamin Johnson told police he awakened early Saturday to a loud noise and smoke alarms going off in his apartment. Deputy Police Chief Rich McLean said Johnson saw a hole in his ceiling and ran upstairs to find a man had been shot in the leg. Johnson stayed with the victim until officers and medics arrived. Johnson told police he had no recollection of handling the .44 Magnum handgun, which he said he keeps on the headboard of his bed. McLean said Johnson had not been drinking. The victim was taken to a Bozeman hospital with critical injuries and was listed in fair condition.
Two Atlanta men have pleaded not guilty to forgery charges filed in Montana that prosecutors say are a part of a multi-state scheme in which up to $210,000 in bad checks were cashed. The Billings Gazette reports 25-year-old Ryan Vincent Hill and 21-year-old Xavier Cornelius Shields entered their pleas Friday in district court in Billings. Both are charged with several counts of forgery and common scheme. Prosecutor Ingrid Rosenquist said the men had been involved in cashing as much as $60,000 in bad checks in Montana and as much as $150,000 in bad checks in South Dakota. Rosenquist said the men were also wanted in Nebraska, Maryland, and Georgia. Charging documents say Hill, Shields, and two other men had transients cash the forged checks, allowing them to keep some of the money.
State wildlife officials say permits to salvage road-killed wildlife will be available online beginning tomorrow. The new law that allows for the salvage became effective last month. People who salvage road-killed animals must complete a permit within 24 hours of salvaging the animal. There is no charge for the permits. The Assistant Chief of Law Enforcement for the State Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Department, Mike Korn, says the permit applies only to deer, elk, antelope, and moose.
You cannot take bear. You can't take bighorn sheep. You can't take Rocky Mountain goat. You cannot take any other game animal, any other animal that basically is managed by our department.
Anyone who salvages a road-killed animal must remove the entire animal from the roadway. The salvaged animal must be used for personal consumption and cannot be donated or used for bait or pet food. Some law enforcement officers who respond to collisions with animals will have the ability to process a permit on site, but others will have to go to the State Fish, Wildlife, and Parks website.
Nearly 1 million pounds of oil refinery equipment bound for the tar sands of Western Canada is expected to begin moving through Eastern Oregon today after a night's delay. The load is the first of three that a Hillsborough company is expected to haul through Oregon, Idaho, and Montana on its way to Alberta. The 380 feet long, 23 feet wide, and 19 feet high load is for a water purification system vital for oil extraction. It was supposed to leave Sunday night, but it took longer than expected to load, according to Holly Zander of Omega Morgan. Oregon rules restrict megaloads to traveling only after dark for no more than 8 hours each night. Crews block two-lane highways, pulling over every 5 or 7 miles for traffic to pass. The Transportation Department says delays could be up to 20 minutes. The Eastern Oregon route is about 315 miles, and much of it is on rural sections of Highways 395 and 26. The East Oregonian reported that about 20 people protested last night in Hermiston over the shipment because of environmentalist criticism over its adding to greenhouse gases and aggravating global warming. The company hauled one load of the refinery equipment across U.S. Highway 12 earlier this year, but a federal judge stopped a second load from crossing tribal and environmentally sensitive lands.
PPL Montana has released data showing it made tens of millions of dollars in capital improvements to the Coldstrip power plant between 1995 and 2003. A federal judge approved a settlement today between PPL and the Environmental Protection Agency in a lawsuit filed last year by PPL to keep the data confidential. The 12-sheet spreadsheet contains information about every capital project that cost more than $100,000 at the second-largest coal-fired plant west of the Mississippi. The Montana Environmental Information Center and the Sierra Club requested the data in 2010 under the Federal Freedom of Information Act to determine if the plant was complying with emission requirements. PPL argued the information included trade secrets, but after a settlement conference Wednesday, the sides agreed to a partially redacted version of the spreadsheet.
Mention the YMCA, and many seem to think that its mission begins and ends with its gym and swim services. But John Lang, the executive director and chief executive officer of the Missoula Family YMCA, says the organization offers more than health and wellness services. For instance, the Y happens to be Missoula's largest child care provider. One in every 10 kindergartners entering Missoula County Public Schools graduates from Y Child Care.
In today's world, we know there are certain things that kids need to succeed, and great education is absolutely one of them. We want to make darn sure those kids are ready. The day they show up at kindergarten, their kindergarten readiness helps them in their learning. The next kind of critical piece is third grade reading score. So our after-school programs all have homework help as a part of them. Our summer day camp is done in such a way that the kids are actually learning things all summer long instead of losing what they learned during the school year. If we're going to nurture the potential of every child in our youth development programs, we've got to focus around what kids need to succeed.
We'll have more with John Lang and the YMCA's mission and services later this week in Montana Evening Edition.
Federal wildlife officials say they will review the status of Arctic grayling in Montana to decide if the fish species should receive greater protection on the Upper Missouri River. Today's announcement stems from a legal settlement with wildlife advocates who sued to force the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to take action on hundreds of species. A similar review in 2010 found that grayling warranted protections, but no action was taken because officials said other species took priority. The Missouri River system upstream of Great Falls holds the only North American Arctic grayling population outside Canada and Alaska. The fish are related to trout and known for their colorful sail-like dorsal fin. An initial decision on whether to grant threatened or endangered status is due by September 30th, 2014.
We may all know in a general sense that a security of information we share online cannot be guaranteed, but that doesn't stop us or private business or government from putting sensitive data online. The hope is that security will hold up against hackers, but in fact, cyber attacks are a growing security threat. David Hammond advises the U.S. government about that threat. He is director of Banyan Analytics, a nonprofit government contractor, and he has over 30 years of experience in international security affairs, including cybersecurity. Hammond was in Missoula last week to lecture at the University of Montana. He sat down in our studios with news director Sally Mock to talk about the ongoing threat of cyber attacks.
It happens all the time, every day. One data point, one measure that might be interesting to your listeners, and then from 2011 to 2012, a bipartisan congressional commission was looking into the scope of cyber threats. And in that year alone, there were over 500,000 attacks, cyber attacks of various kinds from outside this country against businesses, commercial organizations, and the government. And 86 attacks on critical infrastructure.
And of course, the motive for these attacks varies. But one interesting thing I read about them is that often it will be done as extortion. The threat will be made. See what we can do, and this will be worse if you don't give us money.
That's a typical tactic used by criminal organizations. They have inside information about the vulnerability of systems, especially for companies, and they will extort essentially money from some companies in exchange for not exploiting those weaknesses.
And that goes on all the time?
That goes on all the time, and because companies don't want to report it, because it obviously reflects these vulnerabilities publicly, both to their shareholders, to their corporate officers, and to their competitors, they often do it in silence. I really couldn't tell you, there really isn't good data available on how pervasive that part of it is, because the cyber threat takes other forms other than the extortion and the criminal exploitation.
What is, do you think, our biggest vulnerability? Where are we most vulnerable?
Our financial systems, without question. Our financial systems make use of the internet so they can function, so they can make transactions, they can talk to their other operating units, so they can communicate with their customers, they can communicate with their other creditors, at the retail level as well. And it was designed to make use of an internet that was designed by a group of people initially that wanted to have an open, transparent sharing of information so that all citizens could prosper and could use it to the fulfillment of their own ambitions and goals. Those wonderful people that created the internet did not take into account the security aspects and the vulnerabilities. And so what we see now is any time there can be an exploitation of some weakness somewhere for profit, there will be someone doing it. Whether it's a criminal organization, whether it's an anarchist, whether it's a state-sponsored organization that does it as a way of an asymmetric threat to protect their own interests, or if it's just someone who just has a grievance.
I would have guessed that you would have said that our power grid.
That is a subset of the vulnerabilities. I think that the power grid, because they're publicly owned, are publicly managed and overseen, and because it's been well established that they're probably the have lots and lots of vulnerabilities. I think the tide is just changing with that, because both the Congress and the state power regulation commissions and the Department of Energy itself have recognized that this is a huge problem and are taking steps to address it. And I believe that in the fullness of time that we'll be able to overcome that. The financial system, in my opinion, is a different story, because they're obviously all privately held and their weaknesses are never publicly disclosed. They don't disclose them to their shareholders, to their customers. They don't disclose them to their competitors, to the public at large. And, the vulnerabilities and the weaknesses are oftentimes hidden and covered up for all the reasons that you would expect for being a business. But until it's recognized and addressed that there are common problems among the financial industries, I think the problem is going to continue. Also, they're the most vulnerable overall, because there's more profit to be in them.
Of course, these companies and the government are working all the time to prevent these attacks. But you argue that these entities should also prepare for the inevitability.
Correct.
The consequences are where we're sort of falling short. What do we do when this happens successfully?
Oftentimes, when this situation is exercised and the vulnerabilities are uncovered, the exercises fall short of sort of long-term sustainment of the problem. And we need to look deeply into this problem for the worst case and really discover all of the cascading and symptomatic problems associated with a long-term problem, not being having access to your finances, your funding, the ATMs, having a critical power infrastructure being offline for a considerable amount of time. And this is all designed, these exercises and these trials, so that you can build resilience into a system, knowing that there is an opportunity or a chance in the future that this is going to crash or become a huge problem.
Mm-hmm. Prepare for the worst. Right?
And in fact, the government has been very active about trying to prepare the citizenry for these kinds of disasters. And since Katrina, we've had a number of different disasters that have proven that you need to look after yourself and take resiliency, starting with the family unit, building up from there to, you know, your communities.
We've been talking about cyber attacks as if it's only something that someone would do to the U.S., but the U.S. has considered cyber attacks elsewhere.
I think the information on our capabilities for offensive cyber operation or a well-kept government secret, so I couldn't comment on that. I think it's a safe bet, though, that our military forces have the capability to strike back or to perpetuate an offensive operation should the need arise to protect national security. And this isn't a new notion. I mean, the capability to use a digital weapon, if you will, of some kind to take down, say, air defenses was considered in the first Gulf War initially. It was ultimately rejected, but we had the science and the operational ability to do it then. So it's a safe bet that we're fairly sophisticated in our ability.
Considered, wasn't it, also in the discussion of what we were going to do with Syria?
Exactly. It was a discussion. And again, I think the public discourse on that kind of came to a close because I don't believe they wanted the terrorist organizations associated with what's going on in Syria, knowing what our capabilities are. The other problem with the Syrian question was that assuming that, you know, we could act with some offensive capability to cause harm to the Syrian government, the terrorist organizations that are operating there and the other non-state actors, non-state groups, you know, would continue to press forward in their struggles. And so they wouldn't do anything to help that. And so ultimately the people that are involved in this conflict, the innocent people, would still continue to get killed and be harmed.
And, of course, the cyber war would not be something we really want to engage in.
No, absolutely. And the main reason for that is there's but a very short step between having a cyber conflict where you're really targeting systems, digital systems, computer systems, and a hot war. And the distance between the two is a short distance, not territory that we really want to discover or find out. And a good example of a history, I think, is how we've come to learn to live with nuclear weapon escalation that we had learned to address in the 60s. Riding up that escalatory ladder and retaliation potential, even if we had the weaponry and the means to deliver it, didn't mean we really wanted to consider doing it. That's the same with the cyber.
And I have been speaking with David Hammond, who's director of Banyan Analytics. Fascinating conversation. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight should be partly cloudy with some haze and lows 13 to 20 degrees. Tomorrow calls for partly cloudy skies, haze, and highs in the mid-30s to lower 40s. Central Montana tonight will be partly cloudy with lows 15 to 25 degrees. Tomorrow, look for partly cloudy skies and highs in the 40s. And in southwest Montana tonight, it should be partly cloudy with lows in the 20s. Tomorrow, expect partly cloudy skies and highs 35 to 45 degrees.
Currently in our listening area, Helena is 33 degrees with fair conditions. In Kalispell, it's partly cloudy and 31 degrees. Butte has 36 degrees under clear skies. Great Falls is fair with 35 degrees. Here in Missoula, the temperature is 35 degrees and with partly cloudy skies. It's 35 degrees and clear in Dillon. In Hamilton, it's partly cloudy and 32 degrees. Libby has 29 degrees with partly cloudy conditions. And in Polson, skies are cloudy and it's 28 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Bruce Farling.
Pretty much can't swing a dead cat these days without hitting some politician, Chamber of Commerce spokesperson, or Tea Party activist lecturing about how government spending is chaining future generations to a bottomless maw of debt and impoverishment. To them, it's always about protecting the future, the kids, the grandkids. Fine. But it's difficult to take these concerns seriously when the same folks are willingly indebting future generations over costly decisions affecting natural resource development, decisions in which the economic benefits accrue to a favored few for a short period today in exchange for passing off extravagant costs to future generations. This is the case when politicians and their industry sponsors ignore the substantial transgenerational cost resulting from the human role in changing the climate. We release the greenhouse gases today, get the benefits, then bequeath to future generations the costs, such as increased drought, rising sea levels, more frequent and destructive wildfires, and reduced food production. Montana suffers from other inarguable examples of future debt in the form of real money, millions of dollars, being handed off to future generations. And those who complain loudest about government deficits are often complicit. State environmental regulators, prodded by conservative deficit hawk politicians and activists, continue to approve mining operations that create pollution in perpetuity. And because pollution has costs, it is being addressed by simply handing the problem to future Montanans. The examples are many and include contemporary mines. The closed Zortman Landusky mines near Malta, permitted in the late 1970s, produce up to 321 million gallons of polluted water a year. And unless it's treated, it taints local ground and surface water. To prevent this, taxpayers are paying for a collection and treatment of discharges. Because of local geology, the agency scientists who helped approve the mining say this treatment will have to occur for thousands of years at an ongoing cost of untold millions. The shuttered Kendall Mine near Lewistown, another modern operation, today produces millions of gallons of polluted discharge a year, threatening water sources of local ranchers. Though not projected to occur in perpetuity, estimates indicate it could last 40 to 100 years. The pollution is problematic because the state has just a fraction of the money it needs to deal with the problem from the company that created it. Butte's closed Berkeley Pit, a modern mine, and its active sister, the Continental Pit, are producing some 1.8 billion gallons of polluted water a year. And though it's being collected and treated today, it is pollution that will endure for centuries. Who can guarantee that 100 or 1,000 years from now that enough money will be available from long-defunct companies to prevent taxpayers from footing the bill? No one. Similarly, the operating Golden Sunlight mine near Whitehall produces an estimated 52 million gallons a year of acid and metals-tainted discharge near the Jefferson River. Today, the mine treats most of the discharge and has posted a bond to cover future costs. Yet no guarantee exists demonstrating the bond is adequate to cover costs in perpetuity. Defenders of perpetual pollution say leaving bonds will always cover future costs. But no economist today can say with certainty how much treatment will cost centuries hence. Interestingly, some of the same defenders of this approach often argue mightily that state budget offices or Montana's Board of Investments can't predict next year's revenue. But they claim we can project the cost of treating pollution centuries from now. A classic example of bonding proving completely inadequate is the closed Beal Mountain gold mine near Anaconda. Once hailed as state-of-the-art, it is now a source of ongoing metals and potentially cyanide pollution that could last for decades and possibly forever. Taxpayers are paying millions today for emergency pollution control because Montana's regulatory agencies couldn't correctly estimate a bond. And of course, Montana also hosts many older mining areas where the public is paying to protect itself from sites that produced a benefit in the past, such as in the Upper Blackfoot River and Ten Mile Creek watersheds. It is therefore not reassuring that state regulators, some of the same folks who evaluated and underestimated impacts and bonding of the Zortman, Beal, Golden Sunlight, and Kendall mines, might recommend approval of a huge copper operation near the headwaters of the Smith River, a mine that would produce pollution in perpetuity. Approving resource development that creates perpetual pollution is a huge mistake. It should be banned, and the effort to get that done reasonably should be led by those who claim the mantle of deficit hawk. This is Bruce Farling of Montana Trout Unlimited. Contact us at www.montanatu.org.
Bruce Farling is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.